Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The pattern jumps right out of our presidential history. You pledge restraint in world affairs to win the job. You project force in the world once you've got it. Modern examples. George W. Bush, before he launched a war of choice on Iraq, had been a humble internationalist running for president.
America must be involved in the world. But that does not mean our military is the answer to every difficult policy situation, a substitute for strategy. American internationalism should not mean action without vision, activity without priority, and missions without end.
Barack Obama, before he upped the military stakes in Afghanistan, had been clear on the folly of the Bush war in Iraq.
I don't oppose war in all circumstances, and when I look out over this crowd today, I know there is no shortage of patriots or patriotism. What I do oppose is a dumb war.
Donald Trump, before he learned to love trade wars and verbal bullying on the world stage, said that we had been led by lies into the forever wars.
We spent $2 trillion, thousands of lives. We have destabilized the Middle East. They lied. Okay. They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none, and they knew there were none.
Steve Wertheim is our guest this hour. He's the resident historian at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Quincy, for John Quincy Adams, the sixth president of the U.S., son of the second one, who insisted that his country not go abroad in search of monsters to destroy. About the modern American place in the world, Steve Wertheim makes it an 80-year saga about an almost aloof continental sovereign USA that fell from heroic emergency duty in World War II into force projection everywhere, an empire by now in retreat and confusion. Steve's eminently readable new book is titled Tomorrow the World, From the Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in 1940. In conversation this week, I asked him to start at this anxious close of 2020 with the American-Israeli assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist, apparently a joint project of Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu. Have they trapped Joe Biden, who was going to renew the Iran nuclear deal? And he'll be president in 6 weeks in a bit. Are the forever wars being renewed? How are we feeling right now?
Not feeling so good, Chris, but I am personally delighted to be with you. The latest assassination of an Iranian nuclear scientist was predictable. It's a continuation of not just a forever war policy, but the entanglement of the United States in the politics and the military affairs of the Middle East, which by now is a region that increasing numbers of Americans are realizing just is not of vital interest to the United States. But I think you're right. President Trump is trying to make it as difficult as possible for President-elect Biden to return to a diplomatic path with Iran and maybe, just maybe, start to disentangle the United States from the region, which has given us forever wars now for several decades.
It's an instance of what Barry Posen at MIT calls backseat driving, too, with a lesser, smaller ally in the backseat, but steering the car. Can you imagine how Joe Biden gets out of this trap?
It is going to be difficult. The good news is that the Democratic Party, remember when the Iran nuclear agreement was first put forward by the Obama administration, it was very controversial even within the Democratic Party. Now there's been a kind of partisan sorting on that issue. So Democrats are more uniformly in favor of diplomacy with Iran over the nuclear issue. Republicans are pretty much uniformly against. There's a desire to get back into it on the part of Biden, but we'll have to avoid a full-scale war in the meantime, in the transition period. That isn't a given. And Biden will have to resist the calls that I'm seeing routinely now to try to use Trump's so-called leverage to create a quote-unquote better nuclear agreement. The fact is that the United States acted badly in the Trump years. We made an agreement with Iran, and we punished Iran for complying with the agreement that we made. And so what I hope Biden does is get back into compliance, lift the maximum pressure sanctions completely by the Trump administration, get back into compliance with the deal, and then see if Iran is willing to come back into compliance itself. It's got to be clean.
Let's talk about Joe Biden. Still a bit of a mystery to me on policy. Is he committed to ending those forever wars, do you think?
Don't know. He has promised in print and in person during the campaign to bring the forever wars, his term, to a close. But what he said in the next breath was that he would remove the majority of ground troops from Afghanistan and the Middle East. To my mind, that isn't ending the forever wars. I don't think you can be fighting a war and say that it's over at the same time. So he's going to have to act more boldly. It's kind of interesting because Biden himself was a voice against the surge in Afghanistan within the Obama administration. I mean, he had a kind of conventional hawkish past, played an important role supporting the Iraq war, as is well known.
You're talking about the most interesting question about Joe Biden, in my view, how he is going to deal with his past. This sometime senator who voted for perhaps the worst of the forever wars, George Bush's war in Iraq, and we'll get back to that. But then he was vice president too when President Obama extended the war into Afghanistan. I mean, this is a lot to deal with, and he got off rather lightly in the campaign in having to account for this. Do you know what I mean?
I do.
The support for the war in Iraq cost Hillary more than it did Joe Biden, although their positions were almost exactly the same. But now is the time of reckoning.
You're right about that. I'll give him some credit, at least for understanding where voters were in this campaign. It seems like he went out of his way. He made a conscious effort to avoid the fate of Hillary Clinton, to sound stridently militaristic. By the time we got to the general election campaign against Trump, he had blunted the notion that, you know, Trump would be perceived as the anti-war candidate against somebody who was gunning for war. Biden did claim the mantle of ending the forever wars, and he let people know in the primary, I think it was the same debate when he said that he just wasn't going to criticize Barack Obama on the stage. He then turned around later in the debate and let us all know that he opposed from within the Obama administration the surge in Afghanistan, meaning that he disagreed with President Obama at that time. So I think he had a sense of where the electorate lay, the Democratic electorate, at least, and the public at large. So if nothing else, it's true, I think he's gotten off pretty lightly. I mean, frankly, the whole foreign policy class has gotten off too lightly for the Iraq war and the wider war on terror. But at least he seemed to recognize that times have changed, American policy needs to change, and the voters are hungry for a real alternative.
Speak specifically of the other ones, the lesser ones, but the war in Yemen, the idea that he could be back in Syria.
We are back in Syria, and we're currently materially assisting the Saudi-led war in Yemen. The United States also continues to have several thousand ground troops in, yes, Iraq. One of the things that concerns me is the idea that, you know, let's say the war in Afghanistan ends. Let's say Biden lives up to the agreement that the U.S. and the Taliban made and fully withdraws U.S. troops at the very end of April of 2021. I hope that happens. But I also hope that he won't be allowed to say, well, the forever wars have now ended because Afghanistan was the forever war. No, the United States has a massive military footprint. It has ground troops still in Syria, Iraq. Biden himself has pledged to end U.S. support, material support, in the war in Yemen. And I'm certainly looking for him to make good on that pledge. That is the one thing which he's been really categorical about. And even some members of the Obama administration, you know, that intervention, U.S. support for the Saudi side, began under the Obama administration. But to their credit, some of the people in that administration came to regret that move and have called for a reversal of that policy. So that's something that at a very minimum, one would like to see Biden deliver on. But let's be clear, what we have is an entire role in the world by the United States, the pursuit of global military dominance that breeds endless war. As long as the United States sets as a fundamental goal of its foreign policy to dominate the globe militarily everywhere, it is going to be fighting somewhere.
Let's go to the history, Steve. All this super extension of American power, authority, dominance goes back just 80 years to the spring of 1940, the sudden, incredibly shocking collapse of France before Hitler's armies, and England looking to be Hitler's, you know, for the taking. Panic everywhere, understandable, real. Go back to that moment, what was happening in the policy, in the thinking class.
It was such a surprise when Hitler managed to steamroll the largest army in the world, that of France. Before the conquest of France, which happened in just 6 weeks in May and June of 1940, there had been a period of the war in Europe, the so-called phony war, where what most observers in the United States and elsewhere expected was that there would be something like a repeat of World War I, a stalemate, maybe not in trenches this time, but people believed that the defense would still rule the day. In fact, some of the people who had already started thinking about the shape of things to come in the State Department, yes, they were worried about an Axis victory in the war, but they were maybe just as worried that the British and the French would have a rapid victory and they would form an exclusive trade bloc that would block out the United States. But everything changed when Hitler conquered France. It seemed he had achieved what almost no one since Napoleon had even attempted, mastery of Europe. And he quickly formed the Tripartite Pact, first with Italy, then with Japan, and it seemed that Britain was vulnerable. And so now Americans had to ask themselves, what did it mean for the United States and for the world to live with an Axis-led Europe and potentially an Axis-led Asia? And that really changed the thinking in the United States.
Coming up, the slippery I words out there, particularly internationalism and isolationism. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source with the historian Stephen Wertheim. We are revisiting the birth of American supremacy in the world. Global domination as an idea and as a fact. It came quickly after Hitler overran France. It seemed overnight in the spring of 1940. Was the United States going to be in or out of the fight? We've been thinking about this in terms of Frederick Loewenthal's new biography of John F. Kennedy. This whole argument was fought out in the Kennedy family. Ambassador Joe, Roosevelt's kind of loose cannon ambassador to England, was for getting out of the confrontation. Couldn't stop Hitler at this point. John F. Kennedy, Harvard undergraduate, is taking it all incredibly seriously and deciding, no, Dad, the United States must step forward here. This is a real, tangible, memorable argument. And suddenly, important scholars were writing documents to each other and all rallying to the heretofore unknown Council of Foreign Relations, which comes to feel like the foreign policy bureau of the government, but it's outsourced to these policy intellectuals sponsored by the Rockefeller Foundation and others. But these men are not exactly captains of industry or bankers. They're sort of approved thinkers, and so many of them go by three names: Hamilton, Fish, Armstrong, for example. But who were they? And how does their judgment stand up? The idea that, no, this is a moment for American, not only victory, but dominance going forward.
They were interested in seeing the United States play an influential role in the world. You know, they generally expressed the interest of capital. But on the other hand, they were not out to install the United States as the preeminent military force in the world. They were firmly representing a tradition of American nationalism and internationalism that went back a long way. In the first 8 months of the war, they were planning in traditional terms to keep the United States out of what they construed as political and military entanglements in Europe and try to do as much business with the world as possible. And so the armaments group of the Council on Foreign Relations, led by Hanson Baldwin, a New York Times military analyst, and Alan Dulles, future CIA director, what they are doing in the spring of 1940 on the verge of the Nazi invasion of France is cataloging a whole list of proposals for disarmament among nations. They went back to the ancient Greeks who had prohibited poisoning wells, and they went forward to Winston Churchill, who in 1913 had proposed a one-year holiday on naval building. They thought this was really important for people in the State Department to know. And then everything changes with the fall of France. Everything changes with the apparent reality that the Nazis have mastered offensive warfare. The Nazis are going to rule Europe for the foreseeable future. They might even conquer Britain, the British Empire, maybe take the British fleet and the British Empire. And the same group of planners a year later find themselves coming up with schemes for the first time for the United States to be a permanent military policeman of the world, at first in tandem with the remnants of the British Empire.
In your book, I read, I had forgotten this, George W. Bush, governor of Texas, 1999, in his pre-presidential declaration, said, "We have to beware of action without vision, activity without priority, and missions without end." That sounds like classic American internationalism, but it's from there to the White House, 9/11, and $5-10 trillion war of choice that he led against Iraq and Saddam Hussein, who had no role in 9/11. And there are others. I mean, Barack Obama, we're not going to do dumb wars, but he took us back into Afghanistan and we're still there 12 years later. Donald Trump, in the South Carolina debate, said to Jeb, "Your brother lied us into a horribly wrong war." And of course, he has not done big wars, and yet he's extended American influence, mischief, all sorts of things, trade wars included, throughout his term. What sense do we make of the political use of these labels?
Every American president in basically my adult lifetime, George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, start with that election in 1992, has promised to be more humble, more limited in the use of military power. And they come into office and the opposite happens.
Steve Wald blames it on the blob, this amorphous, permanent crowd that makes military and diplomatic policy. Donald Trump would probably say it's the deep state, right?
Right, and that's part of it, but also begs some questions. Why does the blob or deep state or foreign policy establishment think the way it does? The fact is, though, all the presidents who have promised to be more humble, more judicious in the use of military power, have all signed up for the basic U.S. role in the world in which the United States should have unquestioned military dominance. And my view is all the judiciousness in the world, I mean, in my view, it, you know, doesn't get any more judicious as a kind of temperament than Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. But we see the result from his presidency. As long as we are trapped in this consensus that the U.S. must dominate every region of the world and the globe itself militarily, that is just inevitably going to get the United States into interventions. And what staggers me is that if you go by the count of the Congressional Research Service, the United States has used armed force far more frequently after the collapse of the Soviet Union than it did during the Cold War itself. It's not even close.
Is it the military-industrial complex? Is it Lockheed's profits? McDonnell Douglas? I mean, what is driving it?
Well, I think our entire system has become something like an end unto itself. So all of the above is the answer. If we go back to the origins of American dominance, the decision for dominance, that decision was premised on a certain condition in the world. It was premised on the idea that totalitarian conquerors existed, And it would be a problem for the United States and the world for totalitarians to be the premier powers in the world. Thus, it was either U.S. power or their power, us or them. Now, that logic had a certain coherence to it. We can debate whether it was right or wrong or tragic or glorious, but there was a coherence to the argument. That coherence ended when the Soviet Union ended. Totalitarian conquerors that were even plausibly capable of attaining dominance themselves disappeared from the earth, and they've disappeared for three decades. But the United States had built up a system, a blob, yes, a set of experts, a military-industrial complex, as everyone's well aware of since Dwight Eisenhower articulated it for us all, and a political economy geared toward military production. And I think even the persistence of the idea that there are isolationists out there in the United States, whenever anyone raises an objection to the U.S. making another security commitment or using force somewhere or just bringing troops home from Syria or Afghanistan, they can be called an isolationist. That vocabulary, that very partisan vocabulary, has conquered our own imagination. So we have a lot of the problem is quite profound, Chris. And we have a lot of work to do to get ourselves out of this hole.
Yeah, meantime, there's a political shift at the grassroots that's not much commented on. But you and I have both seen the study that the 2016 race turned against Hillary Clinton for Donald Trump, most particularly in the counties of Pennsylvania, Michigan, Ohio, Wisconsin, that had suffered disproportionate losses of their boys back in body bags or opioid cases or paralyzed or whatever. People would rather talk about Russian influence in that election than about those casualties coming home to roost in our politics and working against the virtual incumbent, Hillary Clinton.
That's exactly right. And, you know, Democrats are looking for votes. They are also looking for sources of bipartisanship, one of the few areas where Americans can come together after incredible strife domestically. Certainly, President-elect Biden says he wants to bring the country together. Now, 75% of Americans say they want to bring U.S. troops home from Afghanistan and Iraq. This is a potential source of unity in our country. And I do think that especially politicians who are younger or just younger in their careers, they've just come into Congress in the past 5 or so years, they understand what their constituents want. And it's quite possible that President-elect Biden understands that too. So I have just a little bit of optimism that we are starting to come out of this historic period of demobilization around foreign policy. The politics of our foreign policy are returning. Donald Trump is a clear sign of that. I mean, he's somebody who ran his entire pitch in 2016 was, frankly, a pitch about America's place in the world. It was the United States is being exploited.
Make America Great Again was not a military doctrine, but what was it?
It was a kind of ideological presentation about America's place in the world. Trump argued against globalism that the United States was being exploited by the rest of the world. It was weak in the world. It was being taken advantage of by basically everybody. U.S. allies, U.S. adversaries, immigrants, China, etc. And Donald Trump was going to favor America first, American nationalism, against the forces of globalism, which he also located in a U.S. elite. That was his basic argument. And this is a guy who, you know, ascended in the Republican primary and into office, largely, I would argue, on the strength of what sounded like a fresh argument. He certainly gave a new kind of framing for America's place in the world, one that
I found very concerning, but it's evidence that the kind of traditional America's the global leader, we're exceptional, that kind of rhetoric that Hillary Clinton appealed to in 2016 really lost enthusiasm from voters. And I think Biden has avoided hitting those traditionalist themes too hard or in ways that would make him sound like he was too eager to project force around the globe.
He doesn't go out of his way, as Hillary did, to say the generals know what they're doing out there, for example.
Yes. And even as he is, in some ways, many ways, fetishized the generals, right? Appointed generals to be his initial set of civilian leaders. He's always kind of argued it, used the phrase military-industrial complex at one point, criticized military contractors. He has kept alive a critique of the U.S. national security establishment, for better and worse.
He says so many opposite things, but he's not above chiding Jim Mattis or John Bolton for trying to get me into a war. Like, watch out for those people.
That's right. Now, Donald Trump also appointed all these people, so of course he's totally evading responsibility.
Right. Steve Bertha, I'm glad you mentioned China, because specifically about Joe Biden, he almost advertises the chip on his shoulder with respect to China, as Hillary did about Russia. What does he mean about that? What is his real intention? Taking all of this political rumbling and we need a turn into account.
This is the big question, and we don't know. We don't know yet what he wants to do vis-a-vis China. He and his advisors and the Democratic platform have generally expressed a desire to compete with China more directly and hard-headedly than they say the Obama administration did, for example. At the same time, I expected to see a little more China bashing out of the election in general. And Biden did not, after making a kind of move in that direction, he did not do that as heavily as he might. And one reason might be that Donald Trump overplayed his hand on the virus, clearly trying to deflect away from his own failures to control the spread at home by blaming China for the virus that somehow he simultaneously said didn't really matter. We were turning the corner from. That, I think, has produced a backlash or a greater sensitivity among Democrats or anti-Trump people about the way China bashing is substituting for us focusing on our own problems at home and taking responsibility for our actions. I also think climate change is a big factor. The Biden team is concerned about climate change. Democratic voters in their own right identify climate change and pandemic disease as the top national security threats that the United States faces today, more than China, more than Russia, more than any challenge from a rival nation state. And the fact of the matter is that if the United States is going to continue its drift into a cold war with China, where every gain for one side is viewed as a loss for the other side, in intense security competition, I struggle to see how climate change is going to come under control, since China is the country that emits the most greenhouse gases in the world.
Steve, put the Joe Biden sort of polite China bashing, wariness, not quite hostility toward China, in a different sort of context, the historical context. I wonder, when he talks that way, is this just either in himself or he senses it in people, a symptom of our imperial overstretch? That what does the guy who runs the world worry about? It's this other country thriving, prospering, growing in influence. And it reminds me, I think, of Britain at the end of the 19th century, early 20th, before World War I, worrying about Germany, getting its act together in a big way. Potential rival, Britain still rules the world, but it goes bad, it goes sour, it comes to war when it didn't necessarily have to.
This concerns me a great deal, and there's a tendency on both sides of the aisle
and among the U.S. foreign policy establishment generally, to just see the growth of Chinese power as a problem in and of itself.
Right.
And if that's going to be the case, I worry about our future. I worry, frankly, about eventually getting into a position where the United States can't tolerate any reduction in its military role, and China becomes more expansive and more fearful of the United States. It gets more aggressive, and we are geared up for World War III. We should be making, in my view, every effort responsibly to avoid that situation from happening. And yet, I fear that most people in the U.S. foreign policymaking class are doing the opposite. Mm. They are now talking about extending U.S. commitments in East Asia. For example, the idea of abandoning our policy of strategic ambiguity toward Taiwan and coming out and saying the United States will definitely defend Taiwan. That is a very risky proposition.
And when you think about it, of almost no security implications for the United States of America, for you, me, our bloc, anywhere.
That's right. And I kept hearing my whole life about how the United States had to be the number one military power in the world. But nobody ever seemed to explain, well, why is that? Just walk me through the logic. What would happen if it wasn't the case? So I wrote the book because I wanted to know where this commitment to military primacy came from in the first place.
Coming up, the afterlife of the British Empire in our time. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The dilemmas of American power in the world today, as Stephen Wertheim is arguing, come right out of our own history in World War II and the British Empire before that. Speak of the echoes of the British Empire, which haunt this whole story, it seems to me. I wish we hadn't assumed the British role in the world. But nowadays, I worry, for example, that the biggest rooters for the Iraq War were Englishmen. Tony Blair, Neil Ferguson, Christopher Hitchens. There was a hard left-wing pacifist type who, when push came to shove, supported George Bush in that Imperial War. But here again, how do we look at the rising power out there, and why do we have to make it an enemy? All this feels like a legacy of a British experience that shouldn't be ours, doesn't have to be.
That's right. And when I looked at the origins of U.S. military dominance, what I found, first of all, was that U.S. planners explicitly conceived of the new U.S. role on the model of the British Empire.
Right.
And part of what that meant was that they thought the United States should identify its vital interests with the maintenance of something they called then world order, or what you hear today is the liberal international order. And that, I think, explains a lot of the enmity toward China today. It's the idea not that China is a threat to the United States, exactly. I mean, I don't think anybody loses sleep over Chinese nuclear weapons hitting one of our cities. It's the idea that somehow the United States has to maintain and police world order, and China is a threat to that order, which is incredibly hard to define, troublingly. And the root of that problem does go back to World War II and through to the Cold War, where the United States said it understood that it was secure in North America, come what may, as long as it defended the Western Hemisphere. And its prosperity was also pretty much assured. But it was not enough for the United States to have a merely hemispheric zone of leadership. The United States needed to do more than that. It needed to defend and lead an entire world order. So it's that impulse that really worries me today when it comes to the question of China. Because if China can be slotted into the role of the Axis powers or Soviet communism in the American imagination,
yep,
then we could be in for a sustained
military competition that in the end would be quite ruinous for both powers, or the United States could frankly even lose it. And we'll all lose at the end of the day because the planet will burn.
That revival of a British outlook still strikes me as amazing in the Iraq War case, long after the British Empire vanished. But Neil Ferguson, a child of the Empire, resurfaces with a book called Empire, telling the United States, come out of the closet, you're the world leader, you've got to kick butt around the world, specifically in the Kipling tradition. Pick up the white man's burden, America. And we bought it, or at least George W. Bush used it, was part of the justification of what we were doing in Iraq.
That's right. Now, those same people, still around, still respectable today.
Yep.
You know, Max Boot, for example.
Good example.
Seems he can write anything and the Washington Post will publish it. This is somebody who openly advocated the U.S. taking on the role of something like the British Empire. At the same time, those people at least have to pretend that it never happened today.
Right.
They understand that what they once advocated was unpopular.
And a disaster.
And a total disaster, for which they've never been held to account. And it's something that has grievously discredited so-called experts in general. I think we need a well-functioning expert class. It's a complicated world. Foreign policy is complicated. It's not just going to come from the bottom up. But we need a robust debate at the elite level and at the popular level. And we don't have that. What we have at the elite level seems to go in all in one direction. And that means what you get are these episodic expressions of discontent and leaders like President Trump. So we have a lot of repair to do. And what I worry about in this particular moment is that our leaders will go for restoration rather than repair.
Can I tell you a weird little story about Neil Ferguson, who I consider, you know, a warmongering member of the half-expert but mostly journalistic class? He wrote this book, Empire. Basically, America, go to it in Iraq. It's your job now. And I wanted to interview him, got the book. There it was. The American edition had this cover of a painting of British gunboats, Union Jack flying, firing incendiary bombs into the heartland. And I looked more closely. It was firing onto Bunker Hill in Charlestown, Massachusetts. And I said to him when we talked, that's us under your glorious British bombardment. And we still think that way, part of us, that we are the anti-imperial nation, child of the British Empire, thank you, but goodbye, and go away. And the publisher changed the cover because of that. They want to replay the British glory with American arms and troops.
That's funny, because Ferguson's whole argument was that the United States should not be an empire in denial, and yet I guess changing the picture helps to abet the denial of the past.
Yeah, I wonder, could Americans relearn their ancestral or historical world state of mind without military dominance?
I think it's possible. It's a little hard to see how we get from here to there. Okay, it's very hard to see. But I think it's definitely possible. You know, on the eve of World War II, hardly anybody thought the United States would or should emerge as the dominant military power on Earth, projecting its force across the globe. And yet, in a very short period of time, that's exactly what the United States was gearing up to do. Today, we actually have people like Barry Posen explicitly telling us what a grand strategy of restraint in military affairs would look like. In that sense, we're farther along in working out a different kind of foreign policy than the advocates of primacy were before primacy was conceived. So I think it's possible. Then the question becomes exactly what would force such a dramatic change? What would cause Americans to reclaim some of their finest traditions? People like John Quincy Adams, who said, "We go not abroad in search of monsters to destroy."
of internationalists of the turn of the 20th century who imagined either staying out of power politics or trying to overcome it. It might take something costly, an unexpected event that clearly registers the costs of military dominance to Americans, including to foreign policy elites. Not quite sure what that would be, but I'm worried that it will happen, because if we don't take proactive steps to reduce America's military footprint, what will happen is that our bluff is called by China, by Russia, and we have to decide, you know, are we really going to send our men and women into harm's way to defend Taiwan, for example, or to defend North Macedonia, is now a member of NATO. So we have a period of time still where we can make a different choice, and one that will ultimately be more stabilizing for the world and certainly in America's interest. We have to act proactively.
See, there's a lot of unwinding, undoing to do in our heads. I'm thinking of the American Century, the famous essay by Henry Luce in Life magazine that you quote again. He made it seem so perfectly natural, the American Century. Of course, he said, as natural to us as the airplane or the radio, American inventions which would be tokens of the new regime. But you speak of the costs of primacy from the outset, but specifically now, taught them up a little bit, and not just the military budgets or the casualties. What do you mean by the costs of primacy? What should we be remembering?
It's not just that we spend year after year more than half of our federal discretionary budget on the Pentagon. It's that we're not made safer in doing so, and not only that, we're made less safe. The pursuit of armed dominance makes Americans less safe. It brings enemies upon us. The United States stations its troops, scatters them around the world, enters into pacts to defend other countries. Those who are not in that magic circle become suspicious of that. They resent U.S. power. And then we have real enemies. We get attacked. We have to go to war. It is a downward spiral. But the fact of the matter is, if you pull back, the United States should be in an envious position. I mean, we talk about the most powerful country in the world as if it has no options in the world, and it's just vulnerable to a whole world around it. We are not that vulnerable unless we choose to make ourselves vulnerable. We have oceans that afford immense protection. We have friendly neighbors to the north and south that are much less strong than we are in any case. And we have a nuclear deterrent. This affords the United States an unparalleled opportunity to live at peace with the rest of the world, and instead we choose to go abroad and create monsters to destroy.
You know, there's another Quincy in your book. To me, he's the hero of the book, and I'd never heard of him before. A man named Quincy Wright, law professor, war historian at the University of Chicago, long dead. But as you write, in 1966, 4 years before his death, what he saw out there was American B-52s over Vietnam and no world constitution on the horizon. And he was ready to reckon with the whole idea of U.S. supremacy. I'm quoting your book. He said, "The trouble with the American people is they do not recognize the difference between imperialism and internationalism. In the 1940s, the country jumped from isolationism to imperialism, acquiring a taste for unilateral intervention everywhere in order to remake the world in the image of the U.S., much as Rudyard Kipling's Britain did in its time." So he said, here's what we should do. We should renounce, this is 1966, Lyndon Johnson is escalating in Vietnam. Quincy Wright says, we should renounce unilateral intervention in both Europe and Asia. We should accept Ho Chi Minh's victory in a unified Vietnam. We should bring both Germany's, both Korea's, and Communist China into the United Nations. Such are the policies, after all, to which we committed ourselves in the San Francisco Charter of the United Nations. Thank you, Quincy Wright. Are there Quincy Wrights out there, or are you it for us, Steve Wertheim?
Oh, I don't think I'm it. I'm part of the Quincy Institute, which is not named after Quincy Wright, but rather John Quincy Adams.
Quincy Wright, if he's a hero of the book, he's also a tragic figure because he comes to his realization too late in life. Hmm. He's supported, even with misgivings, he supported essentially everything the United States did in World War II, including the idea that it should be the policeman of the world, at least until some distant time when world opinion strengthened. And the UN, which he called a form of world empire, his words, the UN could be vastly strengthened. So he's right that the foreign policy establishment ended up with something like imperialism, but Quincy Wright supported that imperialism. He hoped it would go in a different direction, and he eventually saw what it became. But Quincy Wright failed to give a genuine alternative and to say no to things like the Truman Doctrine that helped to launch the Cold War.
Well, nobody's perfect. He got off the escalator before he died, and it's more than 50 years ago, and some people are still on it.
Absolutely. It's nothing against Quincy Wright. But I think at a very minimum, we have to liberate ourselves, just as you were saying, from the idea that the choice is in any shape between isolationism or internationalism or something like that. And so in order to truly reimagine America's place in the world, in which the United States is not the overweening military power, we have to dispense with the idea that any kind of reduction in America's military role flirts with isolationism or is tantamount to isolationism, and get on with the question of what kind of role do we want America to play in the world? Not whether it should play a role or not. It's a given. We're going to play a strong role in the world. No doubt about it. And we should. The question is, what kind?
The most hopeful thought, Steve Wertheim, may be simply that the people are ahead of the politicians and the policymakers, and that people like Joe Biden, henceforth, can't just pay lip service to that reservation in the heartland, but they'll have to deliver something.
They will. And there are aspects of what Biden has promised already to end U.S. support for the war in Yemen, to bring forever wars to a close, that are the starting point. But ultimately, we have to go much further. And I think the point you made is exactly right. We shouldn't just be looking to Joe Biden and his team at the top. We should be asking, what are we as a society, as a country, going to do to change America's role in the world going forward for the rest of the 21st century? I know that the rising generation is much more skeptical of military intervention and U.S. military dominance than other generations have been. That's quite clear from the polling data. So I think there is an opportunity. I fear that it will just take a bit too long to avoid the U.S. getting locked into truly destructive antagonisms in the meantime. But I think what's really important, what I'm looking for, you know, over the course of the Biden administration, yes, it's for the Biden administration itself to do some good things, but it's also for Democrats, Republicans, independents, whoever, to be much more vocal than they were in the Obama years, when I think a lot of people heard Obama's opposition to the Iraq war and said, well, he seems reasonable, you know, and he's facing a whole bunch of hawks in Congress, so we'll support whatever Obama comes up with. Well, let's not make that same mistake with the Biden administration.
Steve Wertheim, you've given us a wonderful book, Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. You've clarified our history. You've clarified our situation. I can't thank you enough for this conversation.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thank you so much.
The historian Stephen Wertheim writes and teaches at Columbia University and the Quincy Institute. His new book is Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. Please think of supporting Open Source by becoming a monthly subscriber on Patreon, where you'll find a growing audio library of conversations about literature, politics, and more. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. Max Liebman engineered. Mary McGrath is our All-American Internationalist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.